Book 5 Chapter 20 The death of Santino Corleone sent shockwaves through the underworld of the nation, and when it became known that Don Corleone had risen from his sickbed to take charge of the family affairs, when spies at the funeral reported that the Don seemed to be fully recovered, the heads of the five families made frantic efforts to prepare a defense against the bloody retaliatory war that was sure to follow. Nobody made the mistake of assuming that Don Corleone could be held cheaply because of his past misfortunes. He was a man who had made only a few mistakes in his career and had learned from every one of them. Only Hagen guessed the Don's real intentions and was not surprised when emissaries were sent to the five families to propose a peace. Not only to propose a peace, but a meeting of all the families in the city, and with invitations to families all over the United States to attend. Since the New York families were the most powerful in the country, it was understood that their welfare affected the welfare of the country as a whole. At first, there were suspicions. Was Don Corleone preparing a trap? Was he trying to throw his enemies off their guard? Was he attempting to prepare a wholesale massacre to avenge his son? But Don Corleone soon made it clear that he was sincere. Not only did he involve all the families in the country in this meeting, but made no move to put his own people on a war footing or to enlist allies. And then he took the final, irrevocable step that established the authenticity of these intentions and assured the safety of the Grand Council to be assembled. He called on the services of the Bocchicchio family. The Bocchicchio family was unique in that, once a particularly ferocious branch of the mafia in Sicily, it had become an instrument of peace in America. Once a group of men who earned their living by a savage determination, they now earned their living in what perhaps could be called a saintly fashion. The Bocchicchio's one asset was a closely knit structure of blood relationships, a family loyalty severe even for a society where family loyalty came before loyalty to a wife. The Bocchicchio family, extending out to third cousins, had once numbered nearly 200 when they ruled the particular economy of a small section of southern Sicily. The income for the entire family then came from four or five flour mills, by no means owned communally, but assuring labor and bread and a minimal security for all family members. This was enough, with intermarriages, for them to present a common front against their enemies. No competing mill, no dam that would create a water supply to their competitors or ruin their own selling of water, was allowed to be built in their corner of Sicily. A powerful land-owning baron once tried to erect his own mill strictly for his personal use. The mill was burned down. He called on the Carbonieri and higher authorities, who arrested three of the Bocchicchio family. Even before the trial, the manor house of the baron was torched. The indictment and accusations were withdrawn. A few months later, one of the highest functionaries in the Italian government arrived in Sicily and tried to solve the chronic water shortage of that island by proposing a huge dam. Engineers arrived from Rome to do surveys while watched by grim natives, members of the Bocchicchio clan. Police flooded the area, housed in a specially built barracks. It looked like nothing could stop the dam from being built, and supplies and equipment had actually been unloaded in Palermo. That was as far as they got. The Bocchicchios had contacted fellow mafia chiefs and extracted agreements for their aid. The heavy equipment was sabotaged, the lighter equipment stolen. Mafia deputies in the Italian parliament launched a bureaucratic counterattack against the planners. This went on for several years, and in that time, Mussolini came to power. The dictator decreed that the dam must be built. It was not. The dictator had known that the mafia would be a threat to his regime, forming what amounted to a separate authority from his own. He gave full powers to a high police official, who promptly solved the problem by throwing everybody into jail or deporting them to penal work islands. In a few short years, he had broken the power of the mafia simply by arbitrarily arresting anyone even suspected of being a mafioso, and so also brought ruin to a great many innocent families. The Boquiquios had been rash enough to resort to force against this unlimited power. Half of the men were killed in armed combat, the other half deported to penal island colonies. There were only a handful left when arrangements were made for them to emigrate to America via the clandestine underground route of jumping ship through Canada. There were almost 20 immigrants, and they settled in a small town not far from New York City in the Hudson Valley, where by starting at the very bottom, they worked their way up to owning a garbage hauling firm and their own trucks. They became prosperous because they had no competition. They had no competition because competitors found their trucks burned and sabotaged. One persistent fellow who undercut prices was found buried in the garbage he had picked up during the day, smothered to death. But as the men married to Sicilian girls, needless to say, children came, and the garbage business, though providing a living, was not really enough to pay for the finer things America had to offer. And so, as a diversification, the Boquiquio family became negotiators and hostages in the peace efforts of warring mafia families. A strain of stupidity ran through the Boquiquio clan, or perhaps they were just primitive. In any case, they recognized their limitations and knew they could not compete with other mafia families in the struggle to organize and control more sophisticated business structures like prostitution, gambling, dope, and public fraud. They were straight-from-the-shoulder people who could offer a gift to an ordinary patrolman but did not know how to approach a political bagman. They had only two assets, their honor and their ferocity. A Boquiquio never lied, never committed an act of treachery. Such behavior was too complicated. Also, a Boquiquio never forgot an injury and never left it unavenged, no matter what the cost. And so by accident, they stumbled into what would prove to be their most lucrative profession. When warring families wanted to make peace and arrange a parley, the Boquiquio clan was contacted. The head of the clan would handle the initial negotiations and arrange for the necessary hostages. For instance, when Michael had gone to meet Salozzo, a Boquiquio had been left with the Corleone family as surety for Michael's safety, the service paid for by Salozzo. If Michael were killed by Salozzo, then the Boquiquio male hostage held by the Corleone family would be killed by the Corleones. In this case, the Boquiquios would take their vengeance on Salozzo as the cause of their clansman's death. Since the Boquiquios were so primitive, they never let anything, any kind of punishment, stand in their way of vengeance. They would give up their own lives, and there was no protection against them if they were betrayed. A Boquiquio hostage was guilt-edged insurance. And so now, when Don Corleone employed the Boquiquios as negotiators and arranged for them to supply hostages for all the families to come to the peace meeting, there could be no question as to his sincerity. There could be no question of treachery. The meeting would be safe as a wedding. Hostages given, the meeting took place in the director's conference room of a small commercial bank whose president was indebted to Don Corleone, and indeed some of whose stock belonged to Don Corleone, though it was in the president's name. The president always treasured that moment when he had offered to give Don Corleone a written document proving his ownership of the shares to preclude any treachery. Don Corleone had been horrified. "I would trust you with my whole fortune," he told the president. "I would trust you with my life and the welfare of my children. It is inconceivable to me that you would ever trick me or otherwise betray me. My whole world, all my faith in my judgment of human character would collapse. Of course, I have my own written records, so that if something should happen to me, my heirs would know that you hold something in trust for them. But I know that, even if I were not here in this world to guard the interests of my children, you would be faithful to their needs." The president of the bank, though not Sicilian, was a man of tender sensibilities. He understood the Don perfectly. Now the Godfather's request was the president's command, and so on a Saturday afternoon, the executive suite of the bank, the conference room with its deep leather chairs, its absolute privacy, was made available to the families. Security at the bank was taken over by a small army of hand-picked men wearing bank guard uniforms. At 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, the conference room began to fill up. Besides the five families of New York, there were representatives from 10 other families across the country, with the exception of Chicago, that black sheep of their world. They had given up trying to civilize Chicago, and they saw no point in including those mad dogs in this important conference. A bar had been set up in a small buffet. Each representative to the conference had been allowed one aide. Most of the dons had brought their consiglieres as aides, so there were comparatively few young men in the room. Tom Hagen was one of those young men, and the only one who was not Sicilian. He was an object of curiosity, a freak. Hagen knew his manners. He did not speak, he did not smile. He waited on his boss, Don Corleone, with all the respect of a favorite earl waiting on his king, bringing him a cold drink, lighting his cigar, positioning his ashtray with respect but no obsequiousness. Hagen was the only one in that room who knew the identity of the portraits hanging on the dark paneled walls. They were mostly portraits of fabulous financial figures done in rich oils. One was of Secretary of Treasury Hamilton. Hagen could not help thinking that Hamilton might have approved of this peace meeting being held in a banking institution. Nothing was more calming, more conducive to pure reason, than the atmosphere of money. The arrival time had been staggered for between 9:30 and 10 a.m. Don Corleone, in a sense the host, since he had initiated the peace talks, had been the first to arrive. One of his many virtues was punctuality. The next to arrive was Carlo Tremonti, who had made the southern part of the United States his territory. He was an impressively handsome middle-aged man, tall for a Sicilian, with a very deep sunburn, exquisitely tailored and barbered. He did not look Italian. He looked more like one of those pictures in the magazines of millionaire fishermen lolling on their yachts. The Tremonti family earned its livelihood from gambling, and no one meeting their Don would ever guess with what ferocity he had won his empire. Emigrating from Sicily as a small boy, he had settled in Florida and grown to manhood there, employed by the American syndicate of southern small-town politicians who controlled gambling. These were very tough men, backed up by very tough police officials, and they never suspected that they could be overthrown by such a greenhorn immigrant. They were unprepared for his ferocity and could not match it, simply because the rewards being fought over were not, to their minds, worth so much bloodshed. Tremonti won over the police with bigger shares of the gross. He exterminated those redneck hooligans who ran their operation with such a complete lack of imagination. It was Tremonti who opened ties with Cuba and the Batista regime, and eventually poured money into the pleasure resorts of Havana gambling houses, whorehouses, to lure gamblers from the American mainland. Tremonti was now a millionaire many times over, and owned one of the most luxurious hotels in Miami Beach. When he came into the conference room followed by his aide, an equally sunburned consigliere, Tremonti embraced Don Corleone, made a face of sympathy to show he sorrowed for the dead son. Other dons were arriving. They all knew each other. They had met over the years, either socially or when in the pursuit of their businesses. They had always showed each other professional courtesies, and in their younger, leaner days had done each other little services. The second Don to arrive was Joseph Saluki from Detroit. The Saluki family, under appropriate disguises and covers, owned one of the horse racing tracks in the Detroit area. They also owned a good part of the gambling. Saluki was a moon-faced, amiable-looking man who lived in a $100,000 house in the fashionable Grosse Pointe section of Detroit. One of his sons had married into an old, well-known American family. Saluki, like Don Corleone, was sophisticated. Detroit had the lowest incidence of physical violence of any of the cities controlled by the families. There had been only 2 executions in the last 3 years in that city. He disapproved of traffic in drugs. Zaluki had brought his consigliere with him, and both men came to Don Corleone to embrace him. Zaluki had a booming American voice with only the slightest trace of an accent. He was conservatively dressed, very businessman, and with a hearty goodwill to match. He said to Don Corleone, "Only your voice could have brought me here." Don Corleone bowed his head in thanks. He could count on Zaluki for support. The next 2 Dons to arrive were from the West Coast, motoring from there in the same car since they worked together closely in any case. They were Frank Falcone and Anthony Molinari, and both were younger than any of the other men who had come to the meeting, in their early 40s. They were dressed a little more informally than the others. There was a touch of Hollywood in their style, and they were a little more friendly than necessary. Frank Falcone controlled the movie unions and the gambling at the studios, plus a complex of pipeline prostitution that supplied girls to the whorehouses of the states in the far west. It was not in the realm of possibility for any Don to become showbiz, but Falcone had just the touch. His fellow Dons distrusted him accordingly. Anthony Molinari controlled the waterfronts of San Francisco and was preeminent in the empire of sports gambling. He came of Italian fisherman stock and owned the best San Francisco seafood restaurant, in which he took such pride that the legend had it he lost money on the enterprise by giving too good value for the prices charged. He had the impassive face of the professional gambler, and it was known that he also had something to do with dope smuggling over the Mexican border and from the ships plying the lanes of the Oriental Oceans. Their aides were young, powerfully built men, obviously not counselors but bodyguards, though they would not dare to carry arms to this meeting. It was general knowledge that these bodyguards knew karate, a fact that amused the other Dons but did not alarm them in the slightest, no more than if the California Dons had come wearing amulets blessed by the Pope, though it must be noted that some of these men were religious and believed in God. Next arrived the representative from the family in Boston. This was the only Don who did not have the respect of his fellows. He was known as a man who did not do right by his people, who cheated them unmercifully. This could be forgiven. Each man measures his own greed. What could not be forgiven was that he could not keep order in his empire. The Boston area had too many murders, too many petty wars for power, too many unsupported freelance activities. It flouted the law too brazenly. If the Chicago Mafia were savages, then the Boston people were gavones, or uncouth louts, ruffians. The Boston Don's name was Dominic Panza. He was short, squat. As one Don put it, he looked like a thief. The Cleveland Syndicate, perhaps the most powerful of the strictly gambling operations in the United States, was represented by a sensitive-looking elderly man with gaunt features and snow-white hair. He was known, of course not to his face, as the Jew, because he had surrounded himself with Jewish assistants rather than Sicilians. It was even rumored that he would have named a Jew as his consigliere if he had dared. In any case, as Don Corleone's family was known as the Irish Gang because of Hagen's membership, so Don Vincent Forlenza's family was known as the Jewish family, with somewhat more accuracy. But he ran an extremely efficient organization, and he was not known ever to have fainted at the sight of blood, despite his sensitive features. He ruled with an iron hand in a velvet political glove. The representatives of the 5 families of New York were the last to arrive, and Tom Hagen was struck by how much more imposing, impressive these 5 men were than the out-of-towners, the Hicks. For one thing, the 5 New York Dons were in the old Sicilian tradition. They were men with a belly, meaning, figuratively, power and courage, and literally, physical flesh, as if the two went together, as indeed they seemed to have done in Sicily. The 5 New York Dons were stout, corpulent men with massive leonine heads, features on a large scale, fleshy imperial noses, thick mouths, heavy folded cheeks. They were not too well tailored or barbered. They had the look of no-nonsense, busy men without vanity. There was Anthony Stracci, who controlled the New Jersey area and the shipping on the west side docks of Manhattan. He ran the gambling in New Jersey and was very strong with the Democratic political machine. He had a fleet of freight-hauling trucks that made him a fortune, primarily because his trucks could travel with a heavy overload and not be stopped and fined by highway weight inspectors. These trucks helped ruin the highways, and then his road-building firm, with lucrative state contracts, repaired the damage wrought. It was the kind of operation that would warm any man's heart. Business of itself creating more business. Stracci, too, was old-fashioned and never dealt in prostitution, but because his business was on the waterfront, it was impossible for him not to be involved in the drug-smuggling traffic. Of the five New York families opposing the Corleones, his was the least powerful, but the most well-disposed. The family that controlled Upper New York State, that arranged smuggling of Italian immigrants from Canada, all upstate gambling, and exercised veto power on state licensing of racing tracks, was headed by Otilio Cuneo. This was a completely disarming man, with the face of a jolly, round peasant baker, whose legitimate activity was one of the big milk companies. Cuneo was one of those men who loved children and carried a pocketful of sweets in the hopes of being able to pleasure one of his many grandchildren or the small offspring of his associates. He wore a round fedora with the brim turned down all the way around like a woman's sun hat, which broadened his already moon-shaped face into the very mask of joviality. He was one of the few dons who had never been arrested and whose true activities had never even been suspected, so much so that he had served on civic committees and had been voted as Businessman of the Year for the State of New York by the Chamber of Commerce.